I'm Marty Moscow-Wayne. Welcome back to Radio Times. Here's what Dwight Garner wrote in the New York Times reviewing Atticus Lish's debut novel, Preparation for the Next Life. The book is unlike any American fiction I've read recently in its intricate comprehension of and deep feeling for life at the margins. At its knotty core, amazingly, is perhaps the finest and most unsentimental love story of the new decade. The story involves an illegal immigrant named Zole who works in a restaurant in Queens and lives in an overcrowded rooming house. She meets Brad Skinner on the fire escape of her job. He's haunted by his three tours in Iraq and, like her, is alone. They fall in love. Lish beautifully captures the world of sweatshops and off-the-books factories, cheap restaurants, and graffiti-covered neighborhoods in New York, home to immigrants and criminals and people barely getting by. Atticus Lish lives in Brooklyn and joins us on Radio Times to talk about his book, to talk about his life. I should add, his first book, Life is with People, was a book of cartoons. And Atticus Lish, nice to have you with us on Radio Times, and congratulations on this book.
Thank you very much for having me. It's great to be here.
Very welcome. This is about 5 years in the making?
Yes.
5 hard years in the making?
Yes.
And what was the sort of germ or the sort of beginnings of this book for you?
I would say there were three germs. The first was the Iraq War. And after 9/11, the Patriot Act, the Bush program, everything that the country did at that point, I found disturbing. And so that was one major push, major seed. The other was I had the chance to go with Beth, my wife, to teach in China for a year in 2005. And I was very inspired by the landscape of Western China. And then the third was moving to New York. And New York captured my imagination. That was the third seed of the book.
Let me pick up on a couple of those, because I know you spent about a year and a half in the Marines. You did not go to Iraq, but spent about a year and a half in the Marines.
I spent a year and a half in the Marines between major conflicts. I saw no combat, didn't deploy. That was in 1995. So between—
Before 9/11, obviously.
Long before 9/11, yes.
You know veterans, though, that have served?
Well, I do, yes.
I mean, sort of because just sort of part of the world that you live in?
Not exactly. I didn't maintain contacts with my unit after I got out or anything. But since then, I've talked to a lot of people.
I also read that you had a lot of different kind of jobs, if I can put it that way.
A lot of
physical manual jobs as well.
Yes, absolutely. I worked in a styrofoam factory. What I would do, because I moved around a lot with Beth, so what we would do is I'd go to a temp company usually when we got to a new city, and I would get a job that way. And sometimes they'll send you to a factory, and if you get your hustle going, then maybe you come to somebody's attention and they offer you a permanent job. So I used that strategy a couple of times because we did move a lot.
Sort of like your characters, right? I mean, in certain ways, your characters have a kind of rootlessness to them.
Yes. Yes, absolutely. There's a connection there. I think that's how I that's a natural way to that was a natural way for me to think for a long time. And it's only been recently that I've started to think of folding up the Bedouin tent and putting down some roots.
Tell us about Zole, and then I'd love to have you read from the very beginning of your book. How should we understand her?
Well, the roots of Zole would be when I was out in Western China. She's obviously a composite character in my imagination, but one figure that stands out in my mind, Beth and I were standing in a bus station out in Xinjiang province, and I saw a Central Asian girl, young woman, probably around anywhere between 17 and maybe 20. She was wearing a tracksuit and she had short hair and she was an athlete. She was doing some kickboxing moves, and I talked to her and she said she was a fighter. Also I saw some Tibetan women on the road out there who I wanted to take a picture with, and I went to put my arm around one for the picture and she just tensed up in a way that told me not to go near her. And she was wearing a black cowboy hat, and she had a buck knife, and she was a real kind of cowgirl. And, you know, I found her strong but beautiful. You know, she was tan. She worked outside. People like that put an imprint in my head, and I think that's where Zole comes from.
I mean, something about their physical presence. What you described are two really strong women, sort of warrior women in a certain kind of way.
Yeah, you know, because you'd have to be, because I think when you talk about a migrant person, you're talking about a very vulnerable person. And for a woman who takes those risks, like Mexican women who cross the frontera, they're taking tremendous personal risk. And that to me is an automatically compelling story. And then I would think about, you know, who's the person in that story. So that's where Zole comes from.
Let's have you read from the very beginning of your novel there.
Okay. She came by way of Archer, Bridgeport, Nanuet, worked off 95 in jeans and a denim jacket, carrying a plastic bag and shower shoes, a phone number, waiting beneath an underpass, the potato chips long gone, lightheaded. They picked her up on the highway by a plain white shed, a sign for Army-Navy, tires in the trees. A caravan pulled up with a Monkey King on the dash, and she got in. The men took her to a Motel 8 and put her in a room with half a dozen other women from Fujian and a liter of orange soda. She listened to the trucks coming in all night and the AC running. They gave her a shirt with an insignia and a visor, the smell of vaporized grease in the fabric. Everyone told her, "You have to be fast because the bossy watching you." They didn't speak each other's dialects, so they spoke English instead. Her first day, her worn-out sneakers slipped on the grease. She dropped an order, noodles popping out like worms, and that night she lay with her face to the wall, her jaw set, blinking. The Americans parked out front, their pickups ticking in the sun, and came in slow and quiet in bandanas and tank tops. They would lean an elbow on the counter and point a thick finger at the menu and say, "That one there." The blacks came in holding what they were going to spend in their hands, the wadded dollars and change. "Is y'all going to let me have them wings? Y'all tell me what I can get with this, then." She knew how to say okay. When they pointed at the menu, she got it fine. In Nanuet, they wanted the all-you-can-eat. She could understand that. "You need to get some more of this." Okay, she knew how to hurry up and get something, to work because she had to work 14 hours a day every day until the 10th or 11th day, until they got a smoking day, as the boss called it, because it was better than picking through the trash in the brigade field south of the river. In the motel, they kept the TV running to practice English. They squatted on the carpet, moving their mouths in the blue light, seeing the grocery store aisles and the fast cars. "Unbelievable," they said. "This Tuesday on Fox, a grim day in Iraq." She watched goggled soldiers and radio antennas driving past adobe houses in the desert which she had lived in. "Camel," she pointed. "The animal. It's very good." "Too hard," they said. "It can't be absorbed. Mind is a wooden plank." Someone yawned. "Have to practice it a lifetime."
And again, Atticus Lish reading from the very beginning of his debut novel. It's called Preparation for the Next Life. You so capture in this book this underground economy. I mean, I don't even know what to call it, but this whole world of immigrants and people living on the edges, trying to make a living. It does feel like survival of the fittest.
Right. I was very inspired by a wonderful book called The Snakehead by Patrick Radden Keefe. It's about the Golden Venture tragedy in which a ship called the Golden Venture ran aground off of Far Rockaway. It contained Chinese illegal immigrants from Fujian province.
And who had to sort of figure it, sort of in a sense kind of sneak into the city, but also there was this whole world that took them in.
Yes, he does tremendous investigative research into the network where the immigration, how the immigration worked. There was the snakehead is somebody who helps smuggle people into this country.
And we in this scene, she's working at a restaurant. You know, people are ordering, and I've often wondered. You know, when you go to especially fast food restaurants or ones that seem a little on the sketchy side. Who are these people?
Right. Who's working there? And there's a personal story here. I mean, one time, several years back, probably 2007, I did go up to Nanuet. We have family up there. That's why it's in here. And when the bus dropped us off at the mall, and I saw a person I'm 99% sure was Chinese came over to me and tried to talk to me. In a dialect I didn't understand. And then a van pulled up, and as if they were suddenly afraid to talk to me, they jumped in the van. And I believe that this was a restaurant worker because they had like a China buffet right next door. And it was a disturbing episode because it looked as if that person needed help. And you hear stories of people who are essentially indentured servants.
Well, it's interesting you tell that story because I can sense it's kind of embedded in this particular novel.
Yeah.
When something like that happens, you make a mental note, you write it down.
Yeah. I didn't have to write this particular thing down. I think it kind of came out. I think it was one of those things that sticks in your head and it finds its way out like a splitter a little bit.
Sure,
yeah.
Sure. And how about Brad Skinner? He's the Iraq War veteran. He had three tours in Iraq. How do you see him?
Well, Brad is a composite character. I wasn't basing him off of any one particular person that I knew. Physically, I thought it was important for me to visualize him. And so I took my mental image of him from the cover of Time magazine.
Oh, really?
There was I couldn't tell you the year, but I think it was actually one of our soldiers who was in Afghanistan. I think the story was actually about Afghanistan, but still a GI. And what struck me about the picture was the contrast between, first of all, how clearly young he was. And also how hard he must have worked, because his hands were the most noticeable thing in the picture. His hands were so beat up and swollen and dirty, and like there was gun smoke around the fingernails. And when I saw that, it looked like he'd been working in a coal mine all day. And it really showed you what infantry life is like. And that was one of the main things I wanted to get across, was how dirty it is to live in the field.
And he's a decent guy. He's done some things he regrets.
Yes, that sums up Brad. I wanted him not to be some kind of a devil. I didn't want him to be. I didn't choose to make him a super soldier. I wasn't thinking of a Navy SEAL or something. I was thinking of an ordinary guy in a regular platoon and what could have happened to him.
And we're almost having a break here. And Zole is very athletic. He's into bodybuilding. I mean, it seems important to you that your characters took or tried to take such good care of themselves, at least physically.
Well, I think Skinner really is more an example of somebody who abuses himself physically, but I know what you're driving
right
at. For him, I think the connection is it's an obsessive repetition of trying to save his friend, and that's where the need to be strong comes from. He wasn't strong enough.
Well, let's take a very short break, and then we'll get back to our conversation. Talking with Atticus Lish in this hour of Radio Times. His debut novel called Preparation for the Next Life is about an illegal immigrant, a young woman named Zole, and also about a Iraq War veteran named Brad Skinner. They meet, they fall in love, things happen. We're going to take a very short break and then get back to our conversation. Stay with us. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscoen talking with novelist Atticus Lish. And his new novel called Preparation for the Next Life, I should add, has gotten some rave reviews. And it's about an Iraq War veteran, an illegal immigrant. They fall in love in a section, I guess it's called Flushing in New York.
That's right.
And to join our conversation, send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. And you can send us a tweet at WHYY Radio Times. When you began this book, did you know it was going to be this love story that it turns out to be? I mean, a sort of tragic, if I can say, love story, but nonetheless, that these two were going to meet and fall in love?
More or less. I started the book thinking of the ending, and then I went back and wrote towards that ending. So I did know that I was headed for a disastrous love story.
Yeah, yeah. And they do meet, she's sort of taking a break from work, and he's in a building, I guess, looking for a massage, right? And they meet, yeah. They meet kind of cute, I have to say.
I'm glad you like that part.
And how do they, I mean, just he sees her, she sees them, and it seems like there's a kind of instant chemistry between the two.
Oh, yeah, yeah. I thought that was important. Right, he's looking around. He's been given a flyer for a massage out there in Chinatown, and so he's hunting around for that. And as he's walking through the corridors of this building, he finds her on her break, and she's much better than whatever he was looking for.
Yeah. And the fact that they're both so physically active, and you look like someone who stays active or perhaps works out. Yes? No?
Well, I owe it all to my jiu-jitsu school.
Oh, is that right?
Yes. Rene Dreyfus, Radical MMA. I'm plugging them right now. Great jiu-jitsu school.
You do MMA?
No, not MMA competition, but it's an MMA school.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah.
So why do you do that?
I do it because it helps me with, first of all, I enjoy it, but I do it because right now because it helps me write.
Oh.
When I go to training, Renee will say you have to forget yourself, you have to flow. And I take that home and I apply that when I write.
Interesting, because writing is so... It's a non-physical in a certain kind of way, right?
It's non-physical, but also and your tush can go numb sitting down.
Oh, just sitting down,
yeah,
right.
Yeah, so you got to get the blood flowing. But the reason I really do that is because if you think too much, I think you can slow yourself down, and it's important to flow. Right. And I get that message a lot, so that's where physical stuff helps.
I don't want to give too much of the story away, but as you said, you began with the ending, a kind of a tragic love story, to say the least.
Right.
And what we see over time is Brad Skinner, the Iraq War veteran, he can't do this. She wants to get married. She wants a relationship. She wants to settle down. It seems like he just can't complete the task.
Yes. Yeah.
Because he just – why is that?
The way I imagine Skinner's character is that he has become nihilistic. He's lost his faith in the things that give us joy.
Right. And because of the war,
yes,
because of his life, sort of what has become of him?
I see this as as damage caused by the war in his particular case. I feel that he didn't make it out psychologically whole. So, yes, that's precisely it. I think we've all heard a lot of cases where people say that the experience of war is so intense that civilian life sometimes pales by comparison. So Brad's a case of that.
Yeah. Well, I'd love to have you read a section from the book, and this is sort of deep into the story. And he's drinking a lot.
Right.
She's working a lot. He's drinking a lot. And this is a particular scene in a bar.
Absolutely. Here goes.
Okay.
So he took a drink from a flask of Bacardi Scorched Cherry and watched an execution on his laptop. A man's body tensed while his killer sawed at his neck. Two men kneeled on him. The audio was bad, and Skinner turned the volume up. That sound was him protesting. The clock was running. The film advanced. The man had become inanimate in the last 30 seconds. Now they lifted up the head, separating it from the corpse. Skinner took another drink from his bottle. The audio was bad because there was sand in his laptop. His hearing was 60% in his strong side ear, the side he held his weapon on. Battlefield dirt got in your body through the lungs and through wounds. He watched IEDs detonating, the explosion blotting out the vehicle, the men, the road, then the brown cloud rolling down and spreading out, and you could see the vehicle at an angle. He watched guys who got hit by a sniper getting punched down. He watched a wounded fighter lying in the dirt. The ground was smeared with a wide red swath of blood. The fighter lifted his AK-47 and the good guys shot him. The sparks went through his body at angles, through his shoulder, chest. Now he lay unmoving. He watched his guys shooting from a rooftop, 10 minutes of jumping footage showing three or four guys, the M60 shaking in bursts, the guys talking, pointing over there, the M60 being turned, the casings falling out like dry feces, set to death metal. He listened to cock rock, thrash metal, big rock ballads, country and western, the numbers they used to play in battle. He turned the decibels all the way up, and it still felt as if he couldn't hear it. And it wasn't because he was deaf, it was because nothing sounded like anything after battle. In his mind, he knew that she was special. He could picture her lying on his bed with the poncho liner winding between her legs and across her bare hip like a green snake and her phoenix eyes on him, a combat fantasy. She was what he had ached for when he had been over there. When he had believed he was going to die, the idea of never having a woman to love him had summed up all his pain. Now, as he sat there with the flask empty on the linoleum at his feet, he checked himself and found his ache was missing. The world was dull or annoying to him, and she was just like any other female, he felt. She had certain functions, and he had seen those functions turned inside out by high explosives. He knew what was inside people, and there was nothing there. It was gross. It was boring. It was sickening, and that was all. The loss of this feeling horrified him. It was yet another thing that didn't work on him. When I was younger, I always wanted to be in love with somebody someday. The thought that that was over, that I couldn't feel that anymore, this hit me really hard. It took my hope away.
And that's our guest, Atticus Lish, reading from his novel, Preparation for the Next Life. And I should add that it is on a one of the finalists for the Penn Faulkner Fiction Prize, just announced this morning. So congratulations on that. I found that passage just so sad. I mean, in certain ways, he kind of toggles back and forth between his life in New York and his life in Iraq. And then he has this woman that he's, you know, in that passage, he doesn't think he deserves, or he has no feeling for.
Yes, that's right. Some of my ideas here come from reading War is a Force That Gives Us Meaning by Chris Hedges.
Sure.
And Chris Hedges characterizes war as a kind of necrophilia. I think I'm enough of an expert to make too big of a claim for everybody here, but this is what he shows, and this is what I took. So it's a kind of necrophilia. He describes an image of a soldier making love to a corpse. After going to that level of intensity and evil, I think some people may come home feeling that they are not capable of doing the normal things that they would like to do, the way they would like to do them. That's how I saw Skinner.
And if you want to send us an email to join the conversation, you can go to radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can send us a tweet at WHYY Radio Times. There's a great sense of place in this book. It feels like you know, as the writer, that you have been to all these places. I mean, your descriptions are very vivid and very real. Are you someone that has sort of roamed the city looking for stories, or
yes,
certain images kind of stayed with you as someone that would walk New York, that lives in New York?
Lots of roaming. I hit the streets. Yeah, I was out there all the time with the notebook. I obsessively walked. Beth and I actually walked all.
And Beth is your wife, I should say.
Beth is my wife. Stood by me during the 5 years writing this, and we walked all over the city.
Just the idea of, were you looking for places to say, oh, I want to write about that street corner, or I want to include that building in my story?
You know, I didn't have to really look for it. I was in love with New York when I got there, especially the parts of the city that are grimier or less appealing perhaps to most people, I found awesome. And I was especially into the outskirts of the city. I walked all over outer Queens and Brooklyn into Long Island. I walked with Beth through Staten Island, around through Jersey, back into the city. We went on monster walks, and I just wanted to see what was there. It's an incredible landscape. And so it wasn't that I wrote the book for it. What it was is I was so fascinated with it, it ended up going into the book. I wanted to use that material. I was interested in it.
And it was important to walk. I mean, you know, you could drive or take a cab, but it was important to walk it, to feel it that way.
Yeah, well, I didn't actually have – I mean, I don't have a car.
Yeah. And well, you live in New York. You don't –
I know what you're going to say. Nobody has a car, but a lot of people do.
No,
cars.
I know they do. Yeah, I've driven around New York. Yeah, a lot of people have cars.
Yeah, where are all those cars coming from? Right? So, I was really into walking during this period. Beth and I were, and then it's kind of tapered off. I guess we're tired, but we feed her.
He pushes her away, though. I mean, at times he tells her to shut up. He calls her garbage. I mean, it's this process, and she wants to marry him.
Yeah.
She wants to get married, even though she's illegal. And there's a question about whether that marriage would be legal or not.
Right. Right. Well, I see her as an optimist, and she's fighting for something. She's a creative – she's a constructive force. She believes in building, and I think Skinner's kind of past that. Mm.
And she has an interesting background herself in that she's part Uyghur.
Yes.
And part – her father was – is
Han Chinese. Her father's – yeah. Right. Yeah, when we were out in the west of China, we saw this first of all, the people who live in western China, for those of your listeners who may not know this kind of thing, that there's a Central Asian people out there, a Turkic people who are called Uyghurs. And so they primarily live in Xinjiang province in the northwest of China.
There were some Uyghurs that were stuck at Guantanamo Bay.
There were, yes.
And you were teaching there in western China?
No. We were teaching in Hubei in central China.
Okay.
But when we got our break, we were able to enjoy a fairly long summer holiday, a government national holiday in China. And you take your pay and you can just get on a train. So we got on a train and just rode clear across the country.
Wow.
Yeah.
Do you think of this as a dystopian – I mean, do you think of this as a dystopian story? And by that I mean – that they're difficult and hard and tragic things that happen in it.
Well, I didn't set out to say that the world is a bad place. What I really was just thinking of was the story for these people. It was about these characters that I would find compelling. What I was focused on about the world is not so much a dystopian thing, but it's the migrant aspect of our new global world, our new global world. Our world is a globe already. the global economy. I've heard that people are moving around a lot more than ever before, and that is interesting. It's like everybody's kind of a Bedouin now. You know, there are all these people who don't have anything except a cell phone, and they're, you know, crossing national borders. They're, in bus stations. They're sleeping. They have no – they're rootless. That sort of migrant life really interested me.
This book has gotten, I have to say, some rave reviews. Does that surprise you? It must be very gratifying, but at the same time – maybe a little scary. I don't know.
No. It's a wonderful thing. It's not. It's all good. It is just an unexpected wonderful thing.
And you said it took 5 years to do this, and you'd never written a novel before. You've written a book before, but really not a novel.
Right. The thing I did before was really drawing, so it wasn't so much writing. I'd never written a novel before, and that of course took a lot of time. I had to figure out how to write a novel, and frankly, I'm still learning.
I mean, was it a matter of reading other novels to see how other novelists had done it, or was there dummy's book for writing novels?
Right. I wish there were. I think one of the big things that helped me was reading Flaubert's Madame Bovary.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah, very, very big help from me because I was looking for something that where there was a love story. Or a story of a woman with some romantic attachments in her life that did not go well. So there's a rough parallel, and the way that I had a hard time dealing with time.
Ah.
I felt I could write a scene, like an immediate scene of, Jack and Jill went up the hill. I think I could write that. But then, 6 years of, Jack and Jill knowing each other and how their relationship evolves, that I didn't know how to go about that. So I needed to see how someone else did it. And so I went to Flaubert for that.
And was this something that did your friends and family besides your wife, did people know you were writing a novel?
No. And the only person on earth who knew about it was Beth. And she was the only one. Yeah.
And was that by design? I mean, just this was a private thing that you were doing?
Well, it was partly by design. I mean, it must have been by design. I just wanted to – I didn't know I could do it. That's the thing. And, the people out there who write are going to relate to this. There's a lot of anxiety that goes with it.
Sure.
And, you put a lot of things on hold. You say, well, there are a lot of things that, might make life better. I'm not going to worry about now. And you want that gamble to pay off, but you can't even dare hope for that. So I really wasn't in a mood to go and advertise to anyone.
And are you a harsh editor of your own work?
Well,
a harsh critic, perhaps?
Well, what I think one of the let me flip that around. I think one of the things that I had to learn to do was to not be perfectionistic. I think that's a key thing that Beth kept pushing me to remember. She said there were a couple times, especially in the beginning, when I would write something and she'd say, okay, honey, you know, that's pretty good, because I showed her everything. And then I would think, nah, it's not good enough, and I'd mess around with it. And she'd say, you over-edited it. And so she has taught me what I think is a valuable lesson, which is don't mess around with things too much sometimes. You know, it's okay if it's rough carpentry as long as it forms a reasonable structure. So that's a lesson I try to hang on to.
I mean, it sounds like you have a very close relationship with Beth, your wife.
Yeah, we're a team. Yeah.
Your team.
Yeah.
And so she's a reader herself, or she knows you, so she knows because books have to be authentic, especially novels.
Well, yeah, she's a fine reader. She and I both really have a lot of the same, you know, view of the world,
right?
And we both like probably similar to the same kinds of books and entertainment, same kinds of movies, especially. So we know what we're looking for, and that's why she is a great reader.
I mean, it's great to have someone you can trust.
Like, yeah,
trust on both on you, but also on what you're writing.
Well, absolutely. I think feedback's so important. If you don't have it, you're sort of just floating in space. Mm-hmm. You need to know, did I do well today or not? It does help a lot.
Well, let's take another short break, and then we'll get back to our conversation. Our guest is Atticus Lish, and his debut novel is called Preparation for the Next Life. And as I just said, just this morning, the Penn Faulkner Fiction Prize announced its finalists for the prize, and Atticus Lish is on that list. We're going to take a very short break, get back to our conversation, open up the lines at 1-888-477-9499. Send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can send us a tweet at WHYY Radio Times. Do stay with us. Much more after this short break. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen talking with Atticus Lish. He has held a number of jobs in his life, working for a moving company, a plastic foam factory, a place called Papaya King. He spent a year and a half in the Marine Corps. He lived and worked in China. He's worked as a translator. And now he can add author to that list with the publication of his new novel called Preparation for the Next Life. And it's about an Iraq war veteran and an illegal immigrant who fall in love. And Lish is talking with us on Radio Times about how he wrote the book. And we did a couple of readings from the book as well. And I do want to talk about his life. And we're taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. Send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. And you can send us a tweet at WHYY Radio Times. In fact, we have an email from Andrew saying, why did you sign up to be a Marine? And did the experience meet your expectations? How did that experience affect the writing of the book?
The Marine Corps, it's a timely question. I just watched Full Metal Jacket last night with the boot camp stuff. Of course, boot camp in 1995 was very different from the way it was during the Vietnam era. Nobody punched you or told you to choke yourself or anything like that. I enjoyed boot camp. I needed to lose 30 pounds, and that helped.
You didn't join the Marines, though, because you wanted to lose 30 pounds, or did you?
I overate a lot when I was younger, and I really did need a crash diet. So I did actually think they would whip me into shape. That was one big reason, and I don't think that's that unusual. I think a lot of people do join the Marines.
That's interesting.
In fact, I saw a billboard or an ad for it that said Marine Corps, the ultimate fitness, health and fitness club, or something like that. Yeah.
So it worked for you, right?
I still work at it, but yeah.
And helped. You were in Paris Island.
Yes.
I also heard, in an interview, that there was a terrible, I guess, murder there while you were there?
It wasn't in Paris Island. When I went to Camp Lejeune, there was a pretty ghastly crime that took place in, August of 96, or the summer of 1996. There was a there was a hold up. A Marine held somebody up, I think at the Kettle, which is a like a pancake house.
Oh, sure.
And I think someone was abducted, and the Marine put them in the trunk of a cab, or put the cab driver in the trunk of a cab and killed them, burned them.
Wow.
Yeah.
Wow.
And that's during peacetime. So, I mean, that probably stayed with me a little bit, because it's a reminder that military bases can be dangerous even in peacetime. In fact, we would get talks about that. You know, when I first got to the School of Infantry, we had a big talk where the man in charge said, I forget his rank, so I called him the man in charge.
Yeah.
The man in charge gave us a lecture. He was like, you know, the people who rob you out here will be your fellow Marines.
Oh, interesting.
So,
so why'd you leave after a year and a half?
I got an administrative separation due to family stress at
that
time.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
So you were feeling some
I hit some family considerations that I needed to take care of.
Not to put you on the spot here, your dad is Gordon Lish, pretty well known.
I'm not on the spot at all. Yes,
editor.
My dad is Gordon Lish, yeah.
Yeah. And which makes me wonder whether you grew up in a house where there was a lot of reading and editing and writing and talk about books and literature.
What there was a lot of was I had access to books. My father had books because of his publishing job, and so I read a lot.
Yeah.
And I had great books to read. That was a tremendous advantage that I'm so grateful for to this day.
And did you, in any time when you were writing this book, wonder what your father would think of it, or how he might edit it, or what advice he might have for you?
Well, actually, no. I had a long period of time where I was out of touch with my family, with Gordon. And, you know, I was older, and so I was not really – that was not a major concern.
Mm-hmm.
I wanted to write a book for my sake. I wanted to write the book that I would want to read. I honestly, at that point, I wouldn't have been able to really know what Gordon would consider a good book or not. I mean, you know, there'd been a long time where the trees grew apart.
And why was that?
I'm going to leave that in the past.
Okay. I mean, it's interesting you call your dad Gordon.
Well, you know, when people get older, they sometimes do
yeah,
that.
Yeah,
it would be
true.
One thing if I was 12 and I was like, Gordon, that'd be a bratty kid, you know.
Well, speaking when you were a little kid, you got an acknowledgement from Don DeLillo, right? How did that happen?
Well, I think that happened because of Gordon's relationship with Don DeLillo, his friendship with Don. And I had written a little composition, and I think Gordon passed it on to Don DeLillo, and DeLillo then used it in his book, and therefore the acknowledgement.
Ah, pretty nice. You were, what, 9 years old or something like that?
Well, I don't think it should be taken to mean that I'd written something so wonderful. I think what it was that, and I can appreciate this now as a writer, he saw a piece that could fit. It's like overheard dialogue almost. You know, like I'll sit on the subway, I'll hear somebody talking, and I'll go, this is great material. DeLillo's book, The Names, that this occurs in, is partly about a child.
Uh-huh.
There's a major character as a child, and I think DeLillo's interested in child language formation, or, you know, the book is about language. It's about how – so I think it just fit a piece that he needed.
And you said you were a chubby kid. Is that true?
I was a well-fed, pampered little boy.
Oh, yeah? I mean, you say that with some disdain.
Well, I love a good croissant.
Well, we
Who
all
doesn't?
Do.
Right.
Yeah, we all do. But do you think you were – I mean, were you a pampered kid?
Yes.
Because you were well-off kid?
Oh, yes, absolutely. Yeah.
And do you regret that now?
Oh, no. I mean, there's first of all, there's no point in having regrets. I'm very fortunate that I didn't have to go through a lot of tough experiences that some children do have to go through.
Right.
I mean, how can I regret my good fortune? You know, I just saw a fascinating documentary called Mexican Fighter. It's about Cain Velasquez. Now, Cain Velasquez is the heavyweight champion of the UFC, and they show footage of his family and how he grew up. His father picks lettuce. You know, his father worked from the time he was five. So, you know, you can't regret being a well-fed little boy.
Mm.
You know, a lot of people have it pretty tough, so no.
Yeah. You went to boarding school, which is kind of unusual, isn't
That's
it?
That's more well-feeding. Yeah. I went to Phillips Academy.
Yeah. And you went to Harvard for a while, dropped out for a while, and then went back.
That's correct. I went to Harvard and dropped out. Then there was about a 10-year layoff, and I wanted to finish college, so I went back and completed. Yeah.
And you've had a lot of jobs in your life. I mean, a lot of sort of physical jobs as well.
That's true.
And
that's
true. And I mean, is that just because you're a physical kind of a guy?
That must be part of it. I think there are a lot of people who, because they have to earn a certain amount, they work at a job, like an office job, that they may not particularly like. I think a lot of people feel cooped up in a cubicle. And I didn't enjoy office work. I'd done a little inside sales, you know, like telemarketing. Mm-hmm. And I preferred to be outside if I could.
And again, talking with Atticus Lish about his debut novel, called Preparation for the Next Life. And again, to join our conversation, you can give us a call at 1-888-477-9499. Send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. And you can send us a tweet at WHYY Radio Times. Were you named for Atticus Finch?
I was.
Were you?
Yeah.
To Kill a Mockingbird?
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Yeah. I mean, that it was obviously a wonderful character.
Yeah, yeah. I have to take that on faith almost. I read the book when I was in seventh grade or something, but it's been a while. I just – everybody says that, so I'm sure he was a great guy.
Yeah. So what got you thinking that you'd like to write a novel? I mean
– I don't know. I just did. I started to feel like it was something I had to do. I think a part of it was, quite honestly, I didn't – have an easy time finding novels that I wanted to read.
Oh, interesting.
And I turned to Beth and I sort of said, you know, we should do one of our own you know, something that we'll really enjoy. So I wrote it for me. I wrote it for her.
And basically made that your job, for 5 years to be a writer?
Well, not quite. My part-time job. I was still working as a translator at that time. But the nice thing about being a translator, I was a Chinese-English translator and I was self-employed. I was freelance. What you can do is you can adjust how much work you take so that you leave a few hours in the day to write. So it was ideal for that.
And I would think being a translator might help as a writer because you're taking language and putting it into another language and kind of seeing how words and phrases and sentences fit together.
Absolutely. It especially helped for this book because through Chinese, I had a window into some of Chinese life. And I was able to talk to people. I talked to a lot of people on the street. I went out to Flushing. I went out to 8th Avenue in Brooklyn, wherever there were Chinese communities. And I was able to interview people and get material.
And when you're writing or when you were writing this book, were there times when it was a struggle to get yourself into that seat? As you said, your butt can get kind of numb if you're sitting there too long. But I've interviewed enough writers to know that sometimes the hardest thing is to get yourself into that seat, that there are all these distractions, things that can keep you from actually writing.
Absolutely. I think pretty much everybody who's in the writing game finds out the same stuff. They all have the same challenges. It's, you know, there's a lot of white space. There's a lot of infinity. Where the, you know, too many degrees of freedom. What do you do? And that can be overwhelming. So there's a lot of stress that goes with trying to write a book.
And did you develop certain rituals about writing? And that's another thing I think writers do. They have sort of a certain place where they like to write and certain kind of pens if they use a pen.
Yeah. Yeah, I did actually. I got desperate at a certain point because I wasn't making enough headway and I had to really pull – I had to make sure I got it done.
Right.
So I said what I will do every morning, I will go down to the local coffee shop and I will sit there for 5 hours. So I started at 6 and I would go till 11. Then I would come back and do my translating job. So I did that every day without fail throughout the winter of probably the last year.
So are you a morning person?
Yeah, much more a morning person, yeah.
And you chose Tyrant Books to publish.
Correct.
This is a very interesting small publishing outfit.
Right, Giancarlo DiTrapano.
And how did you hook up with him?
Giancarlo had done the book of sketches that I did previously.
Life is with People.
Correct. So I knew him through doing that, and I was lucky enough that he liked what he saw, and I said, yes, let's go for it right away.
And was it important to choose or to be part of a small publishing company?
it was important to get published.
Understand that. Yes.
I've been asked this before, and people always react with disbelief when I tell them, you know, because they know about the Gordon connection, they know about my father, so they assume that I have a that I understand the publishing business. In fact, that was not true. While I've had a good relationship with my father over the past since 2006 and returning to New York, we haven't discussed the mm-hmm. book world. And I did not also, you know, he's kind of retired. And so I did not, through him, have access to contacts in publishing. And I made an attempt to learn a bit about how to get published. I didn't know really where to begin.
Huh.
But it was thanks to Giancarlo. I you know what I always say? There's a great line Rakim says, that DJ made my day. That's how he's talking about Eric B. That's how I feel about Giancarlo. He made my day.
And has your dad read the book?
After it came out in galleys, I think someone mailed him a copy, and he has read it. Yeah.
Yeah. Has he talked to you about it, or have you talked to him about it, or does it feel?
Oh no, of course he was great. He was so supportive. He was happy that I had done it, and he said I did a good job in his opinion, and that's a great thing for to hear.
And are you thinking about a second novel?
I'm working on a second novel.
Oh, you
yes.
are. Wow.
Yeah.
Wow.
If the question you're going to ask me is, what is it about?
No, I actually wasn't going to ask
you, because
I know that novelists often don't like to do that.
I felt that hang time, right? And I thought
right.
you're going to ask.
Yeah. No, the question I actually was going to ask, whether it feels different having, now that you have written and had a novel published, whether the second time feels harder, easier, different, same?
It feels easier, just a little bit easier. It's still really tough, but it does feel easier because you're just a little bit more confident that mm-hmm. no matter how confused you are, you'll get it figured out.
And do you feel, I mean, you were in the Marine Corps, but as you said, you didn't serve in any of the wars that we've been fighting recently.
Right.
But do you feel like what you have written is sort of part of these novelists that have been written by oftentimes Iraq or Afghan war veterans, that you sort of feel part of this literature that's coming out now?
Well, that wouldn't be for me to say. Right. I mean, you know, obviously the experience of somebody who has actually gone to war is going to that's a circle you can't claim to join, and you know, unless you've shared what they have. So I won't say that.
Mm-hmm.
Also, that's kind of a matter of interpretation, but it does relate to the war, and it does relate to the difficulty of coming home when you're when you've had a difficult deployment.
Sure. Have you heard from veterans at all?
I have, I mean, not a whole lot, but a little bit, mainly through Words After War. Brandon Willits has an organization in New York, and he's a great guy, and I've mm-hmm. I've gotten to know him a little bit, and I appreciate that.
You mentioned your wife a number of times,
yeah.
Beth. So what does she do, and where did you meet?
Beth works in higher ed, just to protect her privacy. I'm not going to say a whole lot about her, except that she is awesome.
And I got that feeling from you.
Well, she is. and we met when we were both 18, and she was a high school senior, and I was in my first year of college, and we met in Cambridge, Mass.
So was it love at first sight?
Yeah, it was.
Yeah. Really, for both of you?
Well, maybe I shouldn't speak for her.
Oh, I don't know.
You can't do that, but for me.
Well, Atticus Lish, it's been a great pleasure, and congratulations on your book. Thanks for joining us
thank
today
you for having
on
me.
Radio Times. And the book, again, called Preparation for the Next Life, and it's our guest Atticus Lish's debut novel, just been published. And he's speaking tonight at the Free Library of Philadelphia with veteran and writer Phil Klei, who was a guest on Radio Times just about a year ago when his book was first published. Go to whyy.org/radiotimes to find out much more about this program. Kevin Griffin, the engineer for today's edition of the show. It's produced by Susan Greenbaum, Debbie Builder, Emily Bryant, and John Ahrens with Quinn Libsyn. I'm Marty Moscoane. Thank you so much for joining us.